The court, counsel, Alan Epstein representing EMJ Corporation. The first issue EMJ raised on appeal was whether entry of default judgment on liability and damages was premature when co-defendant Lowe's liability had not yet been resolved. After plaintiff filed his opening answer brief, but before defendant filed its answer reply brief, plaintiff dismissed his claim against Lowe's, and this dismissal renders EMJ's first issue moot. EMJ then argued that the trial court abused its discretion in refusing to set aside the default judgment entered against EMJ. Last Thursday, this court ordered the parties to address the implications that Singh versus Mortensen has on this case. And the first implication Singh has on this case is that what was entered against EMJ on November 10th, 2009, in the first instance, was default, not default judgment. When a default has been entered but damages have not been proven, there is no final judgment. Entry of default is an interlocutory order that determines it of itself no rights or remedies. Therefore, although plaintiff's motion was characterized as a motion for default judgment, it was, in fact, procedurally a motion for entry of default. And although the trial court entered what purported to be a default judgment on November 10th, it was really a default. So what EMJ moved to set aside on November 30th, and subsequently in its motion for reconsideration, was a default, not a default judgment.
Counsel, I appreciate that you were not trial counsel, but before the lower court, did EMJ argue that what the judge had done was an entry of default as opposed to a default judgment, and did EMJ argue that a lower standard applied to setting aside a default as contrasted with a default judgment?
The answer to the first question is no. That the argument that it was a default as opposed to default judgment, I don't recall being made. As a matter of law, it was, because of the timing.
Well, there were arguments in the briefs in the trial court that the test was good cause shown. They rapidly changed to a discussion of excusable neglect, but they did argue good cause shown.
Yes, the answer to Judge Webb's second question was the argument that a lesser, less stringent standard should apply was made. And because EMJ moved to set aside a default and not a default judgment, Singh has other implications. The Colorado appellate courts have held that in moving to set aside a default or default judgment, the court must consider, one, whether the neglect that resulted in entry of default was excusable, whether the moving party has alleged a meritorious defense, and whether relief from the challenge judgment would be consistent with equitable considerations, such as protection of action taken in reliance on a judgment and prevention of prejudice by reason of delay. These requirements are to be liberally construed when the motion is promptly made. Resolution of disputes on their merits is favored, especially when motions to set aside are promptly made.
Mr. Epstein, there's no argument here that service was proper, correct?
That service was
proper service was affected on EMJ.
There's no argument that it was not.
Nobody's challenging service.
No.
Okay. So given that there was proper service, how can it be excusable neglect that, you know, these papers land in in-house counsel's desk and he doesn't know what the implications of that are?
I think that under the Singh more lenient test employed by the majority and the good cause standard employed by the well-reasoned concurring opinion in Singh, that that is adequate to meet the test, especially in light of the promptness with which a motion for entry of default was made to set aside. In the Singh decision, this court relied on an Eighth Circuit decision, Johnson versus Dayton Electric, 140 Federal 3rd 781, in which that court held that relief from a default judgment requires a stronger showing of excuse than relief from a mere default order. And without going into detail of the facts of that Johnson case, I would suggest that they are pretty closely analogous to what happened here.
Let me follow up Judge Fox's question if I could. Before the lower court, was anything submitted by way of affidavit or other form of evidence, as contrasted with merely assertions in briefs, as to what exactly happened to the summons and complaint and why it wasn't addressed more promptly? Or was that all just in the briefs?
It's all in the briefs.
Thank you.
Part of it's in the motion to set aside, but it's not supported by affidavit or verified.
Correct. The argument, a factual argument was made. The affidavit of the specific individual at EMJ was not attached to the motion for reconsideration, or the initial motion to set aside, or the motion for reconsideration. And my recollection is that there is explanation advanced by defense counsel what became the damages hearing about what happened. But the person who did this, his affidavit was not attached to anything. But this is a default, and I believe that those allegations are sufficient or should be sufficient under either standard to have set aside the default. In seeing the defendant through the summons and complaint with which he was served out of his car window, and a pedestrian found them and mailed them back to plaintiff's counsel, the plaintiff moved for default judgment, actually moved for default, which the trial court entered. The defendant moved to set aside the default 3 weeks later. The trial court denied the motion, reasoning that throwing the complaint out the window was not excusable neglect. The Singh majority reversed the entry of default as an abuse of discretion. The court reasoned that the trial court failed to consider the defendant's explanation that he threw the papers away in anger. And the court held that the trial court had failed to consider the defendant's contention of a meritorious defense. And finally, the court noted that the trial court had failed to assess any equitable considerations, such as the passage of time or prejudice to the plaintiff, who conceded that no prejudice would have resulted from setting aside the default. And the concurring opinion in Singh agreed that the default should be set aside, but under the good cause standard of Rule 55C, not the Rule 60B excusable neglect standard. And the concurring judge reasoned that the motion to set aside the failure to defend default was filed a very short time after the entry of default, and because there was no allegation of prejudice, the default should be set aside. And I'd suggest that whether applying the Singh majority or concurring approach, the default and subsequent default judgment in this case should be set aside. EMJ's motion was filed 20 days after default was entered. It would have been filed 5 days sooner, but for the fact that EMJ was not listed as a party on the
list. Let me ask you a question, counsel. I didn't practice under the electronic filing system, and so I have to profess some ignorance. If I had a summons and complaint in my hand that has a plaintiff's name, has a case number, and the defendant Lowe's there, and my client is not on the court registry, can't I file an answer using just the case name number, and or am I precluded until it appears in your argument that he couldn't file an answer until his client's name was on the court registry? That seems strange to me.
I'm no expert, but my understanding is that until you first enter an appearance, you can't file anything else on LexisNexis. But again, so that was the explanation given for the five-day gap between defense counsel's knowledge of the service and when the answer was filed. And from my experience, that there is a gap there if you have not yet entered your appearance. I can't explain technically why. I'm not that savvy about it.
Move on to the question of meritorious defenses.
The defenses that were alleged in the answer were comparative negligence and third-party fault.
Were there any specific facts set forth in connection with those defenses in arguments to the trial court, et cetera, that would support them? Or was it just what some might say boilerplate affirmative defenses?
I believe that they were boilerplate defenses. Now, I've read in the file, I don't want to speak out of turn. I read in the file that there was information that, in fact, somebody else sprayed the water.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not suggesting there was a lack of good faith in raising the defenses, and I apologize if that's what it sounded like. I'm asking, in the filings before the lower court, were there any facts put before the court that would flesh out these affirmative defenses, or from the perspective of the trial judge at that time, are they just boilerplate?
I think that what I believe I'm recollecting was not something that was included in a pleading. It was not a specific factual allegation to flesh in the defenses, those two defenses.
Thank you.
Plaintiff argues that EMJ does not have a meritorious defense because it admitted fault. What EMJ is referring to is a Lowe's employee email printout, which states that this Lowe's employee heard an EMJ employee say that EMJ was accountable. This email printout lacked foundation and was inadmissible hearsay within hearsay. It should not have been considered by the trial court for any reason. In any event, this should have been a question of fact to be resolved at trial, not in a default proceeding. Plaintiff also argues that EMJ did not demonstrate excusable neglect because it knew of the claim a year before the complaint was filed, or some time in advance of the complaint being filed. But that's really irrelevant. One doesn't answer a claim. What's relevant is when EMJ became aware of the complaint. And as in Singh, the trial court here did not assess any equitable considerations. The motion to set aside the default was filed less than 3 weeks after its entry, and plaintiff has not alleged any prejudice in setting aside, which would result from setting aside the default. Again, resolution of disputes on their merits is favored in Colorado. EMJ requests that the court reverse the trial court's entry of default and default judgment and remand for further proceedings so this case can be resolved on its merits. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. On behalf of Gary Bosky and Robert Hutchinson, and with me today is my co-counsel, Donald D'Antino. Preliminary to addressing the case of Singh versus Mortensen, I would like to affirmatively state for the record that Mr. Bastian has withdrawn his claim against Lowe's, and that claim has been dismissed with prejudice. With regard to the implications of Singh versus Mortensen, I would like to speak to those and specifically address some of the things that Mr. Epstein did not touch on. One is that Singh versus Mortensen specifically held, as I think implicated by a question by Judge Webb, that facts underlying an affirmative defense must be alleged. And as the court knows, this was not made out of whole cloth. I mean, this, that idea is found in somewhere, and other case law, other Supreme Court cases.
The excusable neglect standard that includes that comes out of Rule 60B. And Rule 60B covers motions made even after trial. I mean, it could be a result of a default judgment. But 60B motions can also be raised after the trial is over for the reasons stated in the rule. And the excusable neglect standard calls for you have to show we have an offense. Isn't that somewhat more important there than it is here where you're within a few days of being served, you have not conducted any investigation, you've not had any discovery, and in the Rule 60B context, you've not tried the case. So you don't know what's going on in the case. How can you possibly prepare affidavits of witnesses you've not met, not yet had an opportunity to?
Every other defendant that has urged reversal has submitted exactly that, an affidavit. We've been unable to find a single reported case where one urged reversal based on a record of no evidence. No affidavit, no testimony. That occurred here. Moreover, the Colorado Supreme Court has consistently held that the standards under Rule 55C and 60B are the same. And I think importantly, Your Honors, is that in Summer, the Supreme Court specifically held that even where there's a default versus a default judgment, that in that sort of a case, there is a very high burden of proof. So even if we assume that there is a more liberal granting of a motion under 55C, nonetheless, that high burden of proof exists. And
what is the meaning of the good for on a showing of good cause, a default may be set aside, and I think it's a semicolon, and then it says a default judgment may be set aside under 55, under 60B, or under the standards of 60B.
Well, is your thoughtful and thought-provoking concurring opinion discusses, I mean, really, there's different verbiage, and arguably there are different applications. However, what I think is germane is that over three decades, the Colorado Supreme Court has consistently held that the standards really are the same, number one, and number two, the high burden of proof does exist. So that, and one other point, Judge Roy, is, you know, when we talk about good cause, we would argue that even assuming arguendo that it was simply good cause, we would submit there has been a good cause showing of good cause. We would submit there has been no showing. Why? Because there has been no affidavit. There has been no evidence. There has been no testimony. And as the court knows, jurors are routinely instructed that statements of counsel are not evidence. The truth of the matter is we don't know whether or not it was some issue with EMJ's in-house counsel. Now, we might have been able to better determine that had EMJ done the simple task of filing an affidavit. I mean, and I think what's particularly egregious here is that EMJ had numerous opportunities to do all of this. And they never did. And moreover, EMJ has never denied the statements of their agent that they are liable. They've never denied that. You heard Mr. Epstein say, well, it's hearsay. You didn't hear him say, we deny it.
But if the trial court in fact relied on that email, why wouldn't that be more properly in front of the trial court as a summary judgment motion or at trial as opposed to in a default judgment situation?
Well, I think the court could consider that for the reason that it is not hearsay. Under Rule 801D, an admission by a party opponent is not hearsay. And the trial court did give the other side an opportunity to respond. As you know, the EMJ had the opportunity to file a reply brief. There was the motion, we filed our response, they had the opportunity to reply. They never did that. They had the full opportunity.
Regardless of what standard is applied here, I mean, don't we have to also decide it in the context of the fact that courts or our preferences to decide cases on the merits as opposed to on a procedural basis?
I think in general that's true. However, I think one aspect of that makes this case egregious is the fact that, number one, they failed to allege any facts to support an affirmative defense, and number two, they failed to present any evidence, and number three, they actually admitted fault, which totally undercuts.
What is the admission of fault? This gentleman saying to Lowe's that they may be accountable?
Yeah, he's.
I've read the record. I mean, it's in emails exchanged within Lowe's where they say this guy said Joe Abbott.
Right.
That they're accountable. You think that's a judicial admission of liability?
Well, I don't know if it's a judicial admission, Your Honor, but I do think it's an admission.
Well, not by the company. Are you suggesting the company's admission?
Yes, by the company.
Who is Joe Abbott?
He's the project manager, and that is clear from the
So a project manager can enter a confession on behalf of his employer?
A project matter under the rules of evidence can absolutely make an admission that will bind the company, yes.
And accountable to whom? Accountable to Lowe's or accountable to you?
Well, accountable to the law.
Oh.
I mean, I think an admission binds the company for legal purposes.
I mean, isn't that argument subject to the same problems that I challenge Mr. Epstein on? Is you don't have an affidavit, even from the person in Lowe's, that supposedly heard Mr. Abbott make an inculpatory statement, correct?
Correct.
And you couldn't you actually read these emails as saying the information went from person A in Lowe's to person B in Lowe's, and it's actually person B in Lowe's that authored the email, so there's even hearsay within hearsay?
Certainly, that can be argued, yes.
Okay.
But the burden of proof, as you all know, Judge, is with the moving party.
All right, thank you.
Are you asserting any prejudice?
Yes.
What is the prejudice?
I'm glad you asked that. I was just about to...
I don't recall it in your briefs.
No.
I don't recall it in your briefs in the trial court.
It wasn't. And
so what is the prejudice?
For the reason that the prejudice has to do with actions we took subsequent to the trial court proceedings and subsequent to filing the briefs, which is to abandon, withdraw, and dismiss our claim against Lowe's. That's the prejudice. And when the appellate courts consider the question of prejudice, I think is an example where and In re Goodman might even be another example.
But let me understand this correctly. After the default judgment was entered, you're claiming as prejudice your voluntary dismissal of the claim against
us. Yes. Those. Yeah. Why? Because we relied on the appellate position. We relied on the default that was entered. Those two things, which. I don't think we're going out on a limb here. The Supreme Court in In re Goodman made similar references. When someone relies on judicial proceedings, that's something that can be considered.
The order was under appeal, and two of the issues on appeal related to whether or not summary judgment was appropriate when Lowe's liability had not been determined.
Correct.
So you knew that the default and default judgment was under attack for those reasons.
We
may not have thought they were good reasons, but I mean, you were aware it was under attack.
Your Honor, we knew it, and we knew it in spades.
Pardon?
We knew it, and we knew it in spades. Yes, we did know that.
Okay.
We're not claiming we didn't know that. But we relied on the case law in addition to the various actions that EMJ took.
You have also cross-appealed an issue relating to the delay of the trial court in entering prejudgment interest. Am I correct?
We have.
What remedy are you seeking on that issue?
Well, I don't think at least the parties have any dispute on that question. I don't think there's any dispute about whether the court actually entered the order on time. Our cross appeal was done prophylactically in the event that it could be argued that the court did not act on a timely basis. We think the court did, because as you know, the court ultimately did award interest. We had asked for that, as you know.
Some months. I mean, it was June to almost September, or June into September, before you got the order. But that's not my question, Mike. So are you dismissing that cross appeal here?
No.
Or if you're not dismissing it, what do you want us to do about it?
Well, we want the judgment to be affirmed and for the interest to be awarded. The interest should have been awarded initially. Why? Because we asked for it first in the complaint and second in our closing written arguments to the trial court.
Well, but you have it now. It's been awarded. Are you suggesting it was not awarded properly?
Well, no, not at this juncture.
That you're entitled to more, wrong interest rate, wrong time period?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Ultimately, the court did amend its findings and did award interest, and we're content with that.
So we need not address that issue on appeal?
Well, only in the event that if this court thinks that it was not timely awarded. Otherwise, then no, I don't think it has to be addressed.
I'll ask you the same question I asked before. Are you prejudiced by that?
By the
delay in awarding the prejudgment interest?
I don't think we are at this point, since the court ultimately did award it, and we think did so on a timely basis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm not cutting you off. You have more time.
I appreciate that. I think I have 1 minute left. And
okay, thank you.
Just briefly, the question of whether plaintiff was prejudiced would be prejudiced if the default was set aside. There is no allegation or factual support in the trial record that they would have been prejudiced. The reason that dismissing Lowe's prejudices plaintiff is because that's the only way they felt they could adequately respond to the first issue I raised on appeal, which was that the judgment was premature and this court doesn't have jurisdiction. But that's not prejudice. That's not prejudice in losing evidence or delay of time. And none of that's in the trial record, and that's what the court must examine to determine whether there was an allegation of prejudice made by the plaintiff. With respect to the cross appeal issue, I'm not typically in the business of advocating for the opposing party, but I explained in the answer reply brief that the cross appeal was premised on the incorrect assumption that the trial court had lost jurisdiction after judgment was entered, but because interest had not yet been calculated under the custom home decision, there was, in fact, yet no final judgment. Therefore, the trial court did have jurisdiction.
There had been a notice of appeal filed, as I remember. There had been a notice of appeal filed prematurely.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. I did that once myself. I remember that. I thank both counsel for their arguments and briefs. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.